The AFEM Industry Insider is brought to you by This Is Distorted, the world's biggest producer and syndicator of electronic music programs and podcasts. For more information, go to thisisdistorted.com or at This Is Distorted on socials. On air, on demand, on brand. This is Distorted.
This is the Industry Insider from the Association for Electronic Music.
The AFEM Industry Insider.
Please welcome Nick Holmes.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Glasgow, Nick. So let's start at the beginning. Pre-earning money from music, what was your entry point into this industry, pre-you having a formal job? What was the kind of the starting point for you?
Yeah, well, it really was just about doing stuff for fun, engaging with music and finding ways of doing things that I enjoyed. So me and my best mate used to, do little mobile disco things, but like before we had a... you know, sort of proper decks or whatever. We could take the one high five from my buddy from his home, and then like the flat one from mine. So four speakers, no mixer. And then we'd mix between one home hi-fi and another when we were 12 and we were playing at a ninth birthday party or something, you know, for some kids. So we would be doing stuff like that. And funnily enough, we would get paid, so then a parent would give us 10 quid or something. Oh, thanks for, you know, playing for my daughter's party. But to us, we're just like, wow, we really enjoyed that. That's amazing that somebody's giving us some money for something that we, you know, enjoyed doing anyway. And then I did some other stuff, hospital radio, worked in Bristol Hospital Radio thing, which was a bit of a interesting one, because are you familiar with what hospital radio is? It's sort of like, so in a, you know, probably in Glasgow Royal Infirmary or whatever, you know, there'd be like a in-house radio station that just the patients in the hospital, you know, can listen to. And it's all, you know, dedications, requests, you know, for hospital patients. It's going out to Mrs. Scroggins, she's broken her leg, it's her 82nd birthday, all that kind of thing. So I helped out there, and then they invited me and said, oh, you've been helping out, you can do a show. Oh, great, you know, I thought that's cool. So I took that opportunity, and then it was sort of one evening and a bit of a learning curve, because I thought, oh, this is great, I've got a radio show. I'll just play all the music that I'm excited by, which in those days would have been some fairly, you know, sort of hard-edged American rap records with dubious, you know, lyrical content, I'm sure, some underground banging club stuff. And I started playing all of these records thinking, oh, this is great. Like the station manager came running down, like, oh, no, you know, they'd give everybody a heart attack, you know, kick me off air, basically. And, oh, and now we'll go back to Val Dunican and, you know, Barry Manilow or whatever. So that was, I was learning these lessons. So there, for example, I hadn't really thought about the audience. I was just like playing some music that I was into. But in that particular case, I needed to think a bit more about it. So it was a bit of a schoolboy error, but I was a schoolboy at the time. Yeah. So,
and did that then lead for you to think, you know what, I should get an education? Did you go to university and then cut your teeth around it? Did you see it as a business towards the end of that?
Well, I wanted to move to London, actually, because, you know, I was aware that in London that was, you know, the place where, you know, the record labels, radio stations, except music press were based. So funnily enough, yeah, I knew that I wanted to go to uni, but then I only applied to unis in London because I kind of wanted to be where, you know, the big action was. And then when I was at uni, then I made sure that I was doing interesting stuff. So I was running club nights, working with the social committee to book bands and stuff like that, and just getting stuck in. I mean, there's a few unusual anecdotes there. I do this podcast called Trailblazers, Electronic Pioneers. And funnily enough, there's a little conversation in the Fat Boy Slim episode where we interviewed Norman. I'm talking to him about his time in the House Martins before he became Fatboy Slim. And I was like, yeah, am I right in thinking that your first gig, you know, as a member of the House Martins was at Goldsmiths College? Did I read that? He was like, yeah, that's right, actually. He goes, no, that was a very pivotal night because it was my first night playing with the band and I met my future wife that night. I said, oh, yeah. I go, do you have any idea who was DJing at that event at all? He goes, no, none whatsoever. I go, oh, me. So you know, just getting involved, just doing interesting things, and then interesting stuff can happen from it. So I used my time at uni to do a bunch of interesting stuff.
And that desire to be in interesting places amongst scenes and being at the start of things, is that what led you to choose New York as a place to go to and get some work experience? Was that after university?
Well, I went to work in America whilst I was at uni. So they do these things like summer camp visas, you know, where you can go and work in a kid's summer camp, I suppose, but the role there when you get that visa is you're teaching these kids to play tennis or paint pictures or something, which wasn't me. So I got a work visa, thing called Work America, and then I got a job as a cinema usher, actually, in Queens. And then I knew that I wanted to work in music, so either in records or radio. So I then really blagged my way into New York's leading black music station at the time, WBLS. And I actually called up and asked if I could interview the head of the station. I said, oh, I just thought I'd give it a go. I just called up and said, I'm a journalist from London. I'm writing an article on New York radio, and I wonder if I could interview, you know, Mr. Kirkland, the CEO. And they said, oh, well, we'll speak to him. I thought, oh, that'll be it. Probably I won't hear back. And about 5-10 minutes later, they called back and said, yeah, you can do the interview. That's fine. Can you come in tomorrow morning? I was like, okay. Put the phone down. Then I'm like, fuck. You know, I got to make up some questions. Because, of course, I wasn't planning to do an article on New York radio. But now I've got the interview. Shit, I better make some stuff up, you know. So spent that time panicking, trying to figure out what questions to ask, and got some. Then went in, did the interview, got shown around the station, and then the lady who ran the programming department said, oh, so, well, you know, what? How long are you in New York? I said, oh, I'll be here for a few months. I'm working in the cinema, but I'm trying to get like an internship or something. And she said, oh, okay. She said, if you've got a couple of hours this afternoon, can you help her, you know, sort of file away some records and stuff? Yeah, sure, you know. So I did that, helped them out. And then at the end of the day, she said, okay, so you want to come back tomorrow, 10 in the morning? And I said, oh, you know, wow, like another day of helping out? That's great. I'd be, you know, very happy to do that. So she said, no, not another day. No, like you're our new intern, if you want to be. It's like, wow, can't believe it. Can't believe it. So then I, you know, kind of at the end of the day, I went home. Well, I went to the cinema from there to work. And I'd gone in on this sort of interview blag, and then when I left, I'd got an internship for the rest of the summer. Amazing.
I love that story, because it's so often you hear, you know, stories about the art of the blag, and what does that mean? It's quite vague. That's a very like practical example of what it means to have the art of the blag and be in the right place at the right time. And New York in that time must have been quite amazing. I know you went to Paris Garage and
You
went to some amazing album launch parties as well.
Yeah, I did, yeah. So, yeah, no, I had the album launch party that you talk about. Well, I mean, the thing about WBLS was obviously because it was I was in the programming department. That's like where all the new records came in and we'd log them and the playlist stuff was all formulated and all of that. So you'd get the radio pluggers coming in, dropping off new records and, you know, doing meetings to push their new music. So I got to know those people. And then, yeah, I mean, an amazing turn of events, actually. So one day, the Epic radio plugger comes in. He goes, guys, got a new Michael Jackson album coming. We're going to have a launch party. It's going to be on this massive boat. It's going to go round Manhattan. There's going to be food and drink. Everything's going to be great. And, you know, who wants to come? And I was, it's like, maybe like four of us in the office. And I didn't know whether I was involved, you know, whether I was invited or not. I'm sort of like going, trying to, you know, see if I was allowed to put my hand up, and I give it, and the guy from Epic goes, yeah, you're a good kid, you can come. So like a few weeks later, I literally find myself on this big kind of oligarch type, you know, super yacht, really. Free champagne. I mean, I was probably 19 at the time. So I'd not been to any event where they handed you free alcohol other than like a family wedding or something, you know. So I'm like, really? It's free? Booze is free? Even the champagne? Yeah. Fucking hell. You know, so I could develop a taste for this. Made sure I didn't get completely hammered though. It was an event that had a lot of industry people, you know, people from Tower Records and Billboard magazine and me. And I'm uni kid between my second and third year of uni, thinking, honestly, what the fuck am I doing here? Why am I here? You know, there isn't much advantage to Michael Jackson in having me at his launch party. It's mental. I know I shouldn't be here, but I am. And then at that point, I thought, does that mean that if I'm here and I shouldn't be here and it's completely nuts, could it possibly be the case that some other completely unimaginable nuts stuff might also happen in the future? Like maybe I might be able to get myself a job in the music industry. Maybe I might be able to be involved in something that becomes a hit, or maybe I could make a hit myself, or, you know, all of that stuff seems a bit nuts, feels a bit like a dream, and feels like the sort of thing that kind of probably shouldn't happen. But then again, this shouldn't happen. I shouldn't be here. So maybe it can. And then amazingly, Finn, all of that stuff has happened.
Amazing. And so we've talked about, you know, learning to DJ, the education side, the black side, the positivity and believing things can happen, and the internship. You've then come back to London, essentially. And, you know, there's a lot of amazing indie labels in Glasgow and the Central Belt. And I think when you think about the archetypal indie label, you think XL. They don't sign very often, but when they do, 9 times out of 10, they're culturally massive artists, and they change the landscape. It's Dizzy Rascal, it's Adele, it's The Prodigy. So, I mean, the bit that I suppose I'd love you to kind of explore is, how did you set out for it to be that way when you founded it? And
is the answer. So the idea that an artist like Adele would ever be on XL was completely not in the thinking at the front end of the label, because one of the challenges was we had a record label called City Beat, and I worked for Tim Palmer, who set up City Beat, and we, you know, that label, we were signing records and artists, you know, kind of hoping that we would get radio play and that things would be hits. So there was there was rap stuff, some dance, some kind of soul, and it was a bit disparate. And one of the problems when you're signing records that are across a very wide set of genres is, can you, you know, be consistent? Can you build up an identity and all the rest of it? So there was some challenges with City Beat. So I'd signed, my first hit was a record called Numero Uno by Starlight. So I'd managed to sign a top 10 for City Beat, and they hadn't had one for some years. So that kind of gave me a bit more leeway to, like, maybe do some other interesting stuff. And then myself and Tim Palmer essentially came up, you know, with the plan for a new label. But then it would be a label that was very much tapped into the underground. So we were looking to, you know, have records and artists that would be played by DJs at clubs, on pirate radio, you know, and in the underground. But we weren't thinking about radio records or mainstream album success. Just wanted to put out some cool shit, really. And that was the foundation. And then signing cool, you know, interesting, exciting music, which happened.
And what was the A&R process like at the time? Because obviously now we've got unlimited access to thousands of tracks. obviously in that era it's a bit different, and you signed the Prodigy. Like, how did that come about? How did you find the music that you then signed to XL?
So back in those days, you'd get like demo tapes, cassettes, you know, through the post. So you'd have a bit of that going on. You would see white labels that were in record stores. So it's really important to go into record shops and you'd ask the guys who work there, well, yeah, what's hot, what's going on? They go, oh, this just came in, check this one out. And you could get a sense from being in record stores of maybe what future hits could be, because the record store would buy a box of white labels of something, and then they, you know, if they said, hey, we got 25 of these in, they all literally sold out on the Friday afternoon. That's a sign that, like, okay, this record's got, you know, something to it. And then club reaction, you know, so I was out and about in the raves, you know, listening out for records that sounded big, that were getting great audience reaction. And sometimes, you know, sort of just trying to work out what those records were. So there's a couple of examples of that. Do you know Lil Louis, French Kiss? Do you know that record? It was it's one kind of slows down and speeds up record from, you know, many years ago. So, you know, that, you know, that there'd be a record like that where I'd hear that in a club. I heard DJ played at Heaven. I was just like, wow, that, what has that DJ done? Has he manually slowed something down and speeded it up? Ran to the DJ booth. What the fuck went on there? It's like, oh, it's French Kiss, Lil Louis. And then I wrote the record label had a phone number on it. So I wrote down the phone number, and then the next day I called the number on the record. Didn't own the record. The DJ had it. And I go, he goes, hey, it's Louis. Oh, I go, well, is it Lil Louis? You go, yeah. Oh, great. I'm calling, you know, from England. I've, you know, worked for a record label. Uh-huh. You know, and I heard your record, French Kiss, and I'm just wondering if it might be possible to sign it. And he goes, yeah, sounds okay. Okay, I go like, oh, well, like for, like, you know, we could pay in advance, maybe £1,000 or something like that. Does that sound good? He goes, uh-huh. I go, great, okay, well, let's do that then, shall we? He goes, yeah, speak to my lawyer. He gave me his lawyer's number. Speak to my lawyer, wrap it all up with him. Yeah, I'll speak to you later. I'm going to put the phone down. I go, great, have I just signed French Kiss? That was pretty easy. And then call the lawyer up, and then the lawyer doesn't return my call for the next 3 weeks. Then about 3 weeks later, a fax comes through. Fax, it's like a paper email. And it says, like, oh, we've had a lot of interest and we're looking at offers in excess of $20,000. And my boss, Tim, was like, nah, fuck that, you know, that's not happening. So we didn't sign it and it went to number two or something, you know.
It's the way, I mean, if every negotiation was that easy, we would, you know, we'd have a lot more people in the music industry, I think. So you're at XL and then you join EMI as a director to set up Positiva.
That's right.
And so you go from this kind of venerated indie label to being part of a major. What was that cultural shift like? Did it make you feel strange in any way? Was it the same business?
I mean, the two businesses were very different. There's a guy called Clive Black who brought me into EMI. He said, Nick, it's such a big company. He said, something like, you know, it's a little bit like the Titanic EMI. But the difference is at least the Titanic had a good dance band. We don't, you know, we haven't got any dance records. We've tried before. It didn't work. But he said, but that's why I need you. I don't understand all of this dance music stuff, so I'm not saying come over and start a rave label or start a house label, because I don't even know what this shit means. But come over, and can you just do something? Can you sort of do your thing, whatever your thing is? And, you know, we want to have some hits. So, you know, I was very aware that when I was at EMI, you know, having hits is important. I mean, it's not, I wasn't being brought into to sign culturally significant art. They wanted hits. And, you know, even, you know, Clive even pointed out that, that a company like EMI, if you lose $8,000 but have a number six single, probably you would be looked on much more kindly than if you made $3,000 and had a record that went in at number 44. Because for EMI, we need hits, we need top 10, let's be buzzing, let's be on the Radio 1 playlist. Momentum, heat, it goes on the compilations, it'll go on Now and all of that. That's what we need. So don't be thinking about like the pennies like you might have done in the indie world, thinking, shit, we can't pay any more than £1,500 advance. You know, just come in and, you know, just let's get some stuff happening.
And were you scared to fail at any point? Or were you like, I'm good at my job?
Yes, well, yeah, for sure. So after Numero Uno, funnily enough, for City Beat, which was a top 10, it was, I think it might have been a year and a half before I had my next hit, which was probably T99 Anastasia on XL. And I thought I might have peaked. I thought, like, that Numero Uno record, maybe that's as good as it gets. I've signed a top 10, but now we're a year and a half down the line. I haven't signed anything else that's a hit. Maybe that's it, you know? So then I'm, like, was feeling like failure in a way, because I'm like, you know, I'd like some more big records. But then the big records came. And then, you know, it took a year and a bit at Positiva for us to have a proper hit. It was maybe like a year and 2 or 3 months before our first hit, real proper hit. And that was Reel to Reel, I Like to Move It.
That's amazing. I think it's so important to highlight the failures in the music industry because it helps you learn. And it, I think Nick is successful because we've talked about 3 or 4 different jobs he's had, and there'll always be another one, and that helps build your knowledge base, your experience, and more confidence in yourself.
But I tell you, if we hadn't signed Reel to Reel, I Like to Move It, then maybe it would have got to a year and 6 months or a year and 8 months without another hit. And if you're at a major label and you've gone 2 years without a hit, people start to go, you know, really? You know, should we be continuing with this? But the interesting thing about that is that Reel to Reel, I Like to Move It was, you know, there's a parallel between that smash and, funnily enough, Lewis Capaldi, whose manager, former manager I was talking to last night. So you probably all know that Lewis Capaldi, you know, at the start, everybody passed in the UK, passed on signing him. It's quite a well-known thing. Everybody's like, no, we, you know, we don't really see it. Funnily enough, Reel to Reel, I Like to Move It. All of the established dance labels passed. Mm. They said, we can't see this being a hit. You know, it's got a gruff, ragga vocal. That's not going to sit on daytime Radio 1. It's not a rave record. It's not a house record. What is it? What genre lane does it fit in? It doesn't fit in any of them. So there was a whole bunch of reasons that it perhaps wouldn't be a hit. And I thought the same, actually. I'm like, well, I don't know. But then a guy called Dave Lambert, who was sort of my right-hand man at Positive, he's like, you know, Nick, I think it's got a shot. I do think we should have a twirl. So funnily enough, we said to Strictly Rhythm, the American label, said like, okay, we'll give it a go. Can we offer you like a couple of thousand quid, £2,000, sign it for UK and Europe, and we'll give it a go. And they said, we don't have any offers from anybody else. You're a new label. Go ahead, take it, have a go and see how you get on. And became an absolute smash, you know. So, you know, it just goes to show, maybe for you guys, it might be the case. You might be working with an artist that you manage or that you're putting records out with, or you might be an artist yourself and it seems like slow process and you're not getting the bookings that you think you deserve and streaming is slow. Doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong necessarily. You might be doing stuff right, but it just might not be your time yet or what you're doing. The market doesn't quite recognize. It's possible that great success can come despite the fact you're experiencing that. Because the Reel to Reel record, obviously, in the grooves of the record, not only was it a hit for back in the 90s, it's a fucking it's a hit today, isn't it?
Yeah.
Every go to any fucking kids' party now, and they'll know it from Madagascar, and it's become a record that's, you know, gone through the decades. And it was a hit in the grooves of the record back then, but nobody realised it generally. And it, you know, so there's a story of hope there for you if you're finding that, you know, is it possible that this could be a success? Yeah, maybe it is.
At the start of this conversation, I said that Nick was side of stage for all these pivotal electronic moments, and that wasn't hyperbole. We talked about he was there at the first House Martins gig with Fatboy. He was there for the start of the Prodigy. And then when I first met him, he was working with Casper, the dubstep artist. And so that's sort of the beginning area of your management career. Can you talk a little bit about how you got into management, why you exited records and into the management world?
Yeah. So, I mean, the good thing about management is the sort of 360 sort of participation, potentially. It doesn't happen in all management scenarios, but in quite a lot, the management has a chance to be involved in gigs, in records, in merch, etc. And so there was a lot of talk in the industry about 360 models, you know, of operation. And the regular record industry had some real struggles, you know, and it was tough to have hits, and you know, the streaming hadn't really fully kicked in as a model. And, you know, timing, man, it's, you know, I wasn't one of 50 guys in a basement in Croydon in 2007 going, this stuff's good, you know, I need to get involved. I wasn't there. It took me until 2010, maybe 2009, 2010, for the penny to drop on dubstep. I'd kind of heard it. I thought it was a bit boring, really, the dubstep I'd heard. It was a bit, you know, kind of, I don't know, it just hadn't grabbed me. And then basically I went to America. I went to Miami around sort of ultra Miami Music Week time. And I recognized Benga, the DJ, who was queuing up for the same aeroplane as me. And I just recognized him because I'd seen like a picture of him in Mix Mag or something. So I went, I said, oh, excuse me, are you Benga by any chance? And I'm Nick, and I work with the Prodigy, you know, and because at that time I was A&Ring what became the Invaders Must Die album. And I think we just fairly recently released that record through Cooking Vinyl. So we had a little chat. And he said, oh, I'm playing at a party, you know, tomorrow night in Miami. You should come down. And I'd never been to a dubstep gig. So I was like, yeah, I'd like to. That'd be nice. He'd go, I'll stick you on the list. Oh, that's cool. So then the next night I go to him playing. That's my first experience of dubstep in a club. And then I was like, wow, this is fucking good, man. It's exciting. You know, all the kids were like young and, you know, they're all doing that thing. It's like, yeah, this is all right. So I thought, oh, you know, yeah, this feels like something now. It's a good time to get involved. So I actually called Liam Howlett, Prodigy, up from Atlanta Airport on the way home. And I said, oh, you know what? I think we need to get a dubstep remix of the next single, which was Warriors Dance. I think the time's right. And I said, I'll tell you who'd be good. This guy, Benga. I met him queuing up for the plane, you know. And Liam goes, yeah, okay, cool, let's do that then. So then Benga remixes Warriors Dance. Funnily enough, you know, is it coincidence, whatever, Casper didn't have a manager at that point. He was drowning in, like, doing everything, which if you are a self-releasing artist, you'll know the feeling. He was dealing with promoters, organising his sets, trying to get artwork sorted, you know, trying to get some T-shirts done. It's like doing everything, organizing his own transport and all of that, drowning in it. And Benga was like, you ought to get a manager, man. And Casper was like, yeah, I don't know. And Benga was like, you know, no, I think you've got to. I think you should. Casper goes like, well, do you know anybody who might be good? And Benga goes, well, funnily enough, I met this guy, you know, queuing up for the aeroplane. It seems like a decent guy. This Nick guy works with the Prodigy. I don't know, maybe him. And then, so Casper called me up, said, you know, being, you know, kind of come in, have a cup of tea. And he came in and he said, yeah, I'm sort of like, kind of think I need a manager. And I was wondering if you might be interested. And I said, yeah, I am actually. So in that one conversation, I was like, well, I'm up for it if you are. He goes, yeah, all right then. So boom. That was great. And then that was how I started managing Casper.
Deal done. And I think, you know, at that time, there was a period where CD sales collapsed, and it was just before Spotify started. And now we're in an era where the income from DSPs is falling, and Spotify have just announced that less than 1,000 streams a year, you won't get any money from that. Do you find that the worries of the young artists that you were managing in the kind of early 2000s are similar in nature to they are now, and you think it's a cyclical thing, or is this genuinely a more worrying time and a harder time to be a developing artist?
I mean, the thing about the dubstep era was you could feel that culturally there was a sizzly, exciting thing happening, you know. So you might be a young artist working in that space, but I could tell it was a hot area. It was getting press coverage. There were nights popping off. And then when you'd go to the events, you could feel the energy, like, wow, there's something going on. So in that particular scene, there were, you know, it was a good time. I think it's always been challenges for new and developing artists. I mean, it's not like in the rave. I mean, there was a lot of shit records in the rave era. People think, oh, the glory days of rave, everything, there's amazing records coming out every week. There was a load of shit records coming out every week as well that were on white labels, and they didn't go on to have success. But people forget about them, you know. So there's a lot of people who put out records and have done nothing. So there's always going to be that fear in young artists, like, am I going to break through? Is this sustainable? But, you know, what at the moment it does feel pronounced. I mean, the fact that there's more music than there's ever been in the history of mankind, there's now more music at your fingertips. And, of course, if you're a young artist, you're not just competing with other new music that's out, you're competing with everything else, because you can watch any fucking film that you want that's been made ever, basically. Or you can watch any talk about architecture or Celtic or Rangers or astrophysics. You do any of that shit. Comedy, you know, it's like you've got an ridiculous ocean of stuff that you can be involved in and that can use your time. And that means that for all of us, really the amount of time available to listen to music, it kind of gets squeezed. I mean, back in the day, you know, sort of like if you know, I mean, when I was at school, there was like 4 TV channels, no internet. When like the TV stopped, it's like, fuck it, what am I going to do? Read a book or I'll put some records on. They want anything else much to do.
I suppose the flip side of that is anyone that is making art now, they're doing it for the love of it, because it's definitely not a get-rich-quick scheme. So you're very much distilled in an art for art's sake. And that is, I think, the shining light that we should hold on to, that artists coming through now are doing it for the love of it and not for the...
Well, I do think that one thing that is really important is for artists themselves to be, you know, believing in what they do. So, I mean, for example, like, sometimes artists come to me and say, what are you looking for? Because I can sing soul and I can rap a bit, but I can also, like, do housey, dancey stuff. But I've got some indie songs as well. What are you looking for? You know, to me, the brutal answer is, I'm probably not looking for you. Because that person doesn't really know what they are. So my advice to them would probably be, go away, figure out what you want to do, where you think you sit in the market, and then come back and then tell me, okay, I'm an artist, I'm a singer-songwriter, I've got these demos, I kind of see myself as Adele meets Air or Groove Armada, so, you know, kind of chilled, but with an electronic thing. And, you know, that's my space, but I need help to find the right producers and to get my touring going. And now that's an interesting conversation, because the artist knows what road they're driving along. So I can think, like, how can I help them to speed up down that road, you know, and get to where they want to get to quicker if I help out. So I'm kind of looking for artists that are creating their own momentum. And that's really important these days, Finlay, because if you're not creating your own momentum now, You probably will struggle to get good label, manager, publisher knocking on your door, because they're all looking for people who are making shit happen. So, you know, the independent artist needs to make shit happen rather than think, oh, I'll just write some songs and when I've got a manager or a publisher, they'll make shit happen. Nah, I don't think so. I think you've got to make it happen. Get some stuff on SoundCloud. Do some YouTube stuff. Get some gigs. Like, if you're a DJ, like, put on some parties once every 3 months. Get your mates down. Get 50 people in a little basement. Get some footage that makes it look like you're selling out a show and everybody's going crazy. Doesn't matter if they're all your mates and it's a tiny little space. At least you it looks like, okay, third sold out show in Glasgow in 9 months. It's a fact. They're all your mates. Doesn't matter. You know what I mean? You go get the ball rolling.
I've always believed that managers can only help emphasize and highlight momentum. They can't create it. So you've got to do that yourself. And it's the manager's job to paint a picture, tell the story of your art and your momentum that you've already built up.
And in this day and age, of course, even the labels don't want to create the momentum. You know, you go and have a meeting with a major label A&R person, say, here's my songs and this is what I do, but there is no story. Most of them are going to go, keep us posted. Come back to us when there's a story. Because they don't want to take this completely, you know, new thing and try. I mean, I've had this as a manager. I've had conversations with MDs of major labels and gone, I've got this artist. What do you think? You know, maybe you could do, you know, an album firm deal. It's a young artist. Give us 30 grand and let's break this artist together. And they'll say, I'd rather give you 100 grand in 2 years' time, but no. That at that point, I'm a lot closer to being able to go in and bam, dunk it onto the Radio 1 playlist than spend 2 years trying to get it off the ground. This is what we're dealing with.
You've mentioned the importance of live there and selling out the Glasgow gigs to tell the story. You were doing a mobile disco, you know, in the 80s, and now you're doing Reach Up, your club night series. So you're still behind the deck, still on the dance floor.
Yeah.
Do you think the audience has changed in the way they engage with music, or is it fundamentally we're human and we all want that moment to connect on dance floors?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fundamentals are still the same, you know. So back in the 90s, a DJ could play a record that nobody had heard before. And if it was a really wicked, connective, special record, you know, you could see the crowd lift and you'd go, oh, there's something special here. And I think that's the same now. Obviously, people now like to react to records that they've heard on TikTok or whatever it might be. But still, if you're at a club night and a DJ plays a blinding record that you don't recognize, I'm sure you in the club can be like, oh, yeah, this is fucking great. So, you know, people still want to dance. They still want to connect. Of course, the music consumption is different, and it is now. You know, a lot of people are, you know, online is the main entry point, more than, you know, club-based or radio. I think it's very hard. You know, it's hard to run Radio 1 and go, how do we connect with young people? Because young people aren't naturally like, oh, I need to listen to Radio 1 to hear new music. It'd be like, oh, I go on SoundCloud or I follow this YouTube playlist, or, you know, or keep an eye on New Music Friday or whatever it is. So you've got a bunch of challenges, but I do believe that the fundamentals, our principles are still there. And, you know, if you are an artist, I was speaking to these guys down the front here and earlier, I mean, you can probably relate to this. If you do play a good gig, you know, and the crowd responds positively, correct me if I'm wrong, that will give you the energy to see you through the next few days or weeks or maybe longer, to keep you doing what you do, to go out and experience that again. And I think for me personally, you know, there is a danger that the older you can get a bit cynical and you can start to go, fucking hell, it's, you know, it's hard work and it's, it's difficult and it's all changing and everybody's obsessed by TikTok, and I'm not a TikTok specialist, so, you know, and I've not grown up with the format, so, like, you know, I'm not going to be the guy who's all over the twists and turns of that platform. You know, I need to be in environments, I think, where I can feel some energy back to give me the energy to keep rolling it forward. So that's why I really enjoy doing the DJ stuff. I'm out there, I'm with my best mate doing those gigs, the guy that I did the two hi-fis thing with. And that helps me to, you know, play new music that isn't released yet, or maybe helps me to, you know, create new stuff. Because, you know, I think what I'm trying to do is keep that, it's almost that circle of buzz where I'm inspired by something, so I do some shit that's quite good in some respect, that goes into the world, maybe inspires some other people, or some people like it, maybe not, but and then some more good stuff comes back. So I'm trying to keep that loop going almost.
I think it's clear that and what I'm hearing from you is every artist has a community. It doesn't necessarily exist in the top 40 charts. That used to be how you were recognized as a successful artist. If you look at some of the most successful Scottish artists, DJs like Hannah Lang and Ewan McVicar, they're selling thousands of tickets, but they're not necessarily album artists yet, or they're not necessarily in top 10, but they mean culturally a lot in Scotland, and it's reflected in the ticket sales. So it's about finding the tribe that connects with your music and your art.
And everything has to start somewhere, you know, the Hannah Lang. I mean, I actually did a post on socials about Hannah and DOD recently. Now, I've never met Hannah Lang, and I've never had a conversation with DOD either. But I'm impressed with both of them because they've been building and working and have had years of trying and putting stuff out and hoping that it will build, until both of them this calendar year have had hit records. And it's fucking great to see. So I did a post. I don't work with these people, but I'm just like, you know what? I'm actually really pleased that they're having success. Because, like, I think maybe, like, Hannah put her first music out in 2014, DOD in 2011. And it's only now that they're having, you know, hit records. And Hannah only gave up her day job a year ago as a dental nurse. So, you know, that's good to see. But it requires this sort of resilience and building the audience and building your fans. And you got to keep at it and hope that it grows. And, it, you know, and maybe it never will get to the point of what it is for those guys where they're having hits. But if you don't keep at it, then it will, then obviously it's going to drift away. I was lucky enough to ask Niall Rogers once, so what do you do if you're, I mean, you think about Niall Rogers, you think he's a genius and never, you know, would suffer from, like, down periods or whatever, but I say, like, but he has done, and he has had points of his career where there hasn't been much happening. I said to him, "What do you do to move things forward if things are not, you know, connecting?" He said, "Oh, you just got to keep creating, keep turning up. So keep collaborating, take a chance, work with some new people. You know, go to the studio, write a new song. It might be shit, but you've got to put yourself in that environment, pick up the guitar, start writing, and you don't control whether the magic happens, but the magic can only happen if you go and start creating. And if you do it enough, then sooner or later, a bit of magic happens and you're back up and running." And that is something that I see in various successful artists. I mean, the work ethic, so high. From you know, Dave, whatever you think of these people, you know, David Guetta, Calvin Harris, they put in the work in. I mean, you might dislike them as artists, but I'll tell you a quick Calvin Harris anecdote, actually. I was speaking to Mike Pickering, his A&R guy, And Mike was saying, oh, Calvin lives in LA now. He was, God, been over to visit Calvin recently. He goes, God, he's got this lovely house. It's amazing. It's in LA. It's got a beautiful swimming pool and all of that. And Mike Pickering says, he's white as a fucking sheet. You know, I don't think he's ever been in that pool. He's been there 6 months, you know. And basically the vibe was, he's working. Calvin Harris is making music all the time. You know, and he was very successful at that point. But what was he doing? And he didn't have his feet up, just chilling out, you know, just enjoying life. He's still at it.
He's
so there's something
it.
In that, man.
I think that's it. And when I think about the artists that have had longevity of their careers, I used to work with Fatboy Slim, who I know has been a guest on your podcast. And they used to speak about, you don't always have to keep moving up. You can move sideways. And that's as interesting as moving up, because you're reinventing yourself. You're being seen by different audiences. And there's a real beauty and interest in not always being, I need to get bigger and bigger and bigger, but actually I need to get more interesting and more nuanced and expose myself to different areas.
Well, I think if your philosophy is, I need to get bigger and bigger and bigger, you're going to hit some depressing phases of your career, because it's not possible generally for artists to just get bigger and bigger and bigger across decades. Most artists, you know, might get hotter high and it goes down a bit, and then it might go really down, and then it goes back a bit, and they come back with something strong. You know, it's not really just like it doesn't go like that.
Yeah.
So you have to keep it interesting for yourself. And then, you know, if you keep it interesting for yourself, there's a chance that keeps it interesting for your audience. And, you know, I do think that, you know, if an artist goes into the studio thinking, I need to make a big record, I'm in here to make a hit, it's probably not the best frame of mind to be in. Because then you do things like, right, well, let's listen to this thing that was a hit last week. Right, should I be making something like that? No, you probably shouldn't. Because the thing that's a hit, just copying something else that's a hit currently, is probably not what the world needs. You maybe need to do something a bit different. And anybody can go in and go, let's write something like that that's a hit. So, you know, it's about making really good records. Maybe can I make something brilliant? Can I make something that really excites me is a better thing to say than can I make a hit?
Yeah.
And if it really, let's say you going into the studio, Finley, if you can say, I just want to make something that I'm really get a great buzz off, do it. And if you get a great buzz off it, there's the potential that maybe some of these guys, when they hear it, they'll go, yeah, oh, I'm getting a good buzz off it too. And then you're off and rolling. That's really more what my advice would be.
And when you're doing your podcast with the guests that have often had very long, interesting careers, how much of that advice have you been able to pass on to the songwriters you work with, the young artists? Do you find it's transferable, even though the genre might be different and the era might be different?
Oh, loads of it. I mean, I'd advise any of you. There's some amazing resources out there, some amazing podcasts. There's a very good one called Soda Jerker on Songwriting. Have you heard of that? They've interviewed loads of people. It's brilliant. Song Exploder, that's a good one, where they like deconstruct hit records. Have you heard that? It's a really good Dua Lipa example, you know, where they take a song and go, like, they work out, oh, the hook, how did it come along, and whose idea was this, that. There's so much good stuff out there. There's Broken Record, yeah. Rick Rubin in Conversation. And then, yeah, for my podcast that I do with Eddie Temple Morris, I would say there's a lot of stuff that I can learn from these conversations and can sort of recycle myself, because you're always learning, you know, you however long you've been in the industry. And even, you know, a Nile Rodgers, Rick Rubin level, these guys are still, Pharrell, these guys are still learning as well. They're not at a point where they're like, oh, I've learned everything, there's nothing more to learn. Nah, they know that, like, they, you know, that there's always so much more knowledge that we don't know than we do. There's way more shit that we don't know than we do know, and so that inevitably means there's a load to be learned. And And yeah, you know, the random examples that keep coming out in the podcast stuff, there's Daniel Miller, Mute Records, there's an example there where he said, I was going to see an artist in a pub in the sort of Essex, East London borders, and I turned up there, and the artist I was going to see was on at 9 o'clock, but I got there at like 20 past eight or something, and the support band were on, and I thought, oh, I could either check out the support band, who he'd never heard of, or go and have a burger, you know, for 40 minutes and then come back and see the artist at nine that he travelled. He said, I thought, I'll listen to one song from the support band. Why not? And the one song goes, oh, this is good. I stay for another song. Second song. Actually better than the first. This is interesting. I wonder what the next song will be like. Wow, that's really good. Three really good songs in a row. The guys look good. This is interesting. Fourth song. And basically, you know, by the end of the support band set, he was like, yeah, I'd really like to, there's something in this. I'd like to work with these guys. And that was Depeche Mode. And you know, he could have been having a burger. You know, I mean, it might have been a great burger, but of the two, you know, hundreds of millions of albums or, you know. So, he put himself in an environment where something good could happen. I mean, you know, maybe for me personally, there's that phrase. People say, oh, you make your own luck. I actually don't think you make your own luck, because you can't manufacture it out of thin air. You can't force luck to happen. You can't just go, I'm going to be lucky today, and then luck happens. It's not like that. But what you can do is you can put yourself in environments where good fortune is more likely to happen. And funnily enough, this environment that you're in today is a very good example of that. So make use of it and speak to other people. Have a look around the room now at other people here, because that means that in 3 hours' time, you might recognise some of the other people in the room. You might go, oh, you were in that talk with that Nick guy, weren't you? And they go, aye, I was. And then you've got your conversation going. And what do you do? Oh, I'm an artist. What are you? Oh, I'm a producer. Now, might lead to nothing. Or it might be the fucking life-changing meeting, and in 10 years' time, you'd be like, it's amazing. I'm a producer. He's a artist, singer, songwriter. And we met at this thing, made some records together, and now here we are in LA, in a mansion, with a pool that we never use.
What an uplifting moment to end it on. That's fantastic. You're all going to walk away and be millionaires. You heard it here first.
I tell you what though, guys, just before we do wrap, you know, just some other just things. I've talked about the podcast, do all of that. Socials, quick word of advice. Follow people that you think that you can learn from, and let your first engagement with those people not be an ask. So if you want to get an internship at Polydor or whatever, don't let your first ask of somebody from Polydor be, oh, excuse me, I want to get an internship. You know, how can I get an internship at Polydor? Don't do that. Let your first interaction be something else. Let it be something that has some value. You know, if you follow them online and they post like a new act that they're working on, you go, oh, that's really interesting. Love the third clip rather than, you know, that's the best one for me. You know, and oh, I've seen some of their live videos. It's really interesting the way they do this on stage. You're giving something there. That person is like hearing you come with an interesting, you know, educated sort of angle on something that maybe have some benefit to them. And they'll clock that. Like, oh, nice one. Thanks. You know, and then, you know, you can even develop a bit of a rapport sometimes with people. And then a bit down the line, you can go, by the way,
yeah,
have you got any internships going? But then when you pop that question, they already know that you're an intelligent person who said some smart shit and, you know, kind of contributed something already, rather than just knock, knock, I want something for me, please, you know. So I think follow people that you can learn from, put yourself in interesting environments where good things can happen, and then, yeah, do try and create your own momentum.
I think wear your music taste on your sleeve as well. The world is full of music and there's not enough curators. And so I think there's a big gap for people to say, I believe in this music, I believe in this record, whether you work with it or not. So every year I post my singles of 2023.
That's a good thing to do. It's a good thing to support other artists. You know, if you see, if you find another artist that you like, why not share that artist and go, look, this not artist has nothing to do with me, but I just think they're brilliant. So I'm just putting it out there. It's a cool thing to do, you know, and people will appreciate it. And then if you can do that, like, good stuff, then, you know, you're also putting out some positive vibes into the world. And, the world, it isn't like that if you do positive stuff necessarily immediately happens back. It's not as simple as that in the world. In the same way, by the way, if you put out a good record, it doesn't mean that that record will do well. You might put a good record out and nothing much happens, you know. But you got putting a good record out increases the chances of some good things happening. But you're right, you know, yeah, I think try and put some positive stuff into the world and it won't do you any harm, you know. In the same way, other side of the coin, if you spend all your time whinging and moaning, oh, it's so depressing being a artist at the moment, it's so tough, which it is, you know, a bit of that, being honest is fine, but if you do it all the time, oh, I'm so pissed off about this, oh, I'm so sad about that, oh, this is so annoying, you know, you probably, you know, you won't necessarily attract a load of people who want to work with you, you know, because people are attracted to a bit of positive energy. Yeah, you can say, I think this is terrible. And you know what I'm doing about it? I am fucking volunteering at a food bank every Sunday because it's terrible that there's homeless people and what have you. So that's what I'm doing. That's a good thing. Maybe some other people go, oh, I'll do the same, you know, rather than just like, isn't it terrible? Aren't the Tories awful? You know, like, yeah, but, you know, you try and throw some good vibes out there. It's probably something that may serve you well in the long term.
Put the good vibes out there. What a lovely way to end it. Thank you very much, Nick Hawks.
Thank you very much.
The Association for Electronic Music presents
Industry Insider.